I'm not quite sure why I was put last, but it's an opportunity to thank you all for coming. And I'm going to talk about some new stuff, which is very simple and hopefully amusing. Wow. So inflation has certainly turned out to be an amazing phenomenological model. And I just wanted to point out that many people, I guess, did the same calculation Nima was talking about, that if you simply slowly switch off inflation over n e-folds and parameterize it that way, then you get a prediction for n is minus n, 1, which is 3 over n, which for n equals 60 or so is very close to what we observe. And likewise, you get a prediction for the tensor scalar ratio, which we had in our paper, 23%. So I can hardly say that inflation has failed, having written down equations like this. Now, I made a couple of bets with people. Either I bet some rollerblades or ice skates, and I would like to confirm that bet. If bicep is confirmed, I'd be very delighted to buy you a pair of rollerblades. If it is wrong, you won't have to buy me ice skates until R goes below 1%, right? I think that was the bet. Steve and I had a bet, which was actually about the Planck satellite, and I pressed him over 10 years to specify the amount, and I very rashly said, I'll agree to any amount you like for 50-50 odds. But after bicep, he wrote to me and he said, now you've got to pay up. And since I've just paid $100 for the Higgs boson, because he lost that bet too, he said, this is much more important, so you have to pay me $200 Canadian, and I'll be happy to pay up if any of the other experimental groups manages to confirm bicep 2. But let's not forget that there's still some pretty big problems which motivated some of us to look at rival theories, and which are sort of summarized in this picture, which I've always been showing for a very long time. One of them is the initial conditions. Inflation is preceded by a singularity, which we don't understand. The second is that you have to adjust the parameters to small values to get the amplitude of the perturbations right. And then the third and most serious is the cosmological constant, which really leaves us clutching at straws, like the anthropic principle. And of course, if bicep is true, there's sort of another one, which is to explain how it is that you have this field which traverses distances much larger than the Planck mass. It seems it's possible, but maybe it requires some contrivance too. So with all of inflation's impressive successes, I think we can still ask whether there might be a simpler and more predictive explanation for these basic features of the universe. And a bouncing universe is certainly a very natural possibility to explore. Now this morning, whoops, I hope this is going to work. This morning I noticed something on, let's see if this sound is not working. Here we have something bouncing. And this is kind of the this is the state of the bouncing universes, which we're exploring, okay? But I think it's pretty impressive that they're able to do this, and I hope we'll be equally impressive. And you see, it's their bionic kangaroo is able to store the energy from each jump, reusing it for the next. So if only we can do that. A cyclic scenario is attractive because it might provide a dynamical solution to tuning problems in physics, including the smallness of the scale associated with lambda and the Higgs mass relative to the Planck mass. But I won't discuss these here. And I'm going to take a strictly minimalist approach just to see, can we see any way in which to get a bouncing universe while assuming the minimum of new physics? So I want to present a couple of curiosities. The first curiosity is just the simplest possible universe you can think of, really, a flat FRW radiation-dominated universe, which we do believe is where our universe came from. And notice that this metric of this universe is analytic in T, it has a zero at t equals zero, but it's absolutely fine everywhere else. And so it is what I would call an analytic bounce. It passes through a singularity at t equals zero, but certainly if you went around t equals zero in the complex t-plane, it's not singular at all. This feature is kind of reflected also in the perturbations, that if you look at the radiation density perturbation and the tensor modes, they're also single-valued in the complex t-plane. And so if you just avoid the point t equals zero and go around it, in fact, their evolution across or around the singularity is completely unique. So you can follow it in from the negative t-axis to the positive t-axis. There is a question of gauge, but it turns out that, well, obviously, you have to choose a gauge in which this is true. It's very interesting to explore this beyond linear order, and actually I'm doing this with Stefan Gielen, who's here. We don't know what the answer is yet. Second curiosity is, let's go beyond radiation and include lambda. Okay, so lambda, you can solve a radiation plus lambda universe. So the radiation is the beginning of the universe. The lambda is the end of a simple, the simplest case. You can solve this analytically, and it turns out the only singularities in the metric are poles, simple poles, and there is, again, a unique analytic continuation, the complex t-plane. So this metric you can, again, follow to arbitrary t, and it looks like a cyclic universe. Okay, so these are, I don't intend to draw anything deep from this, but it's sort of encouraging that the very, very simplest cosmologies you can think of, which are roughly consistent with what we see, seem to quite naturally be cyclic in this sense. Now let's try to be a bit more realistic and assume, again, assuming no new physics, but starting from the standard model, try to see what we've learned from LHC and what might be happening with physics around these singularities. Now, as you know, one of the most exciting and surprising consequences of the LHC measurements is that the standard model Higgs potential has a second minimum at very negative values, and we live in a metastable vacuum. So the shape of the potential is something like this. We live here at around 250 GeV, but the potential rises and then falls negative at a scale of around 10 to the 10 GeV. And so the first interesting conclusion is the standard model vacuum is on the edge of stability in rather a precise sense. And secondly, as you run this field, that should be sigma, by the way, as sigma goes towards M Planck, the Higgs field goes towards M Planck, something else surprising happens, which is that the beta function for the Higgs quartic coupling crosses zero at around M Planck. So the Higgs potential is just lambda of sigma, sigma to the fourth. The lambda is negative, and according to the best values of the various parameters measured by LHC, the preferred lambda at around the Planck mass is negative, and the beta function has a zero. So that's sort of interesting. And based on that, we can take that as a clue as to what might happen near singularities when the Higgs field becomes very large. So let's look at the standard model and try to see if we can imagine how the standard model might cope with a cosmological singularity. These are, of course, all the charges and so on. Just to emphasize, this is a very tight and consistent structure. The field content is very highly constrained by anomaly cancellation. There are a number of miracles which happen, and one can even argue that if B minus L, an additional U1, is gauged, then there one requires right-handed neutrinos, and so in a sense this can explain the existence of neutrino masses by the seesaw mechanism. There are just four dimensionful numbers in this Lagrangian: the neutrino mass, the Higgs mass, the Planck mass, and the cosmological constant, which is part of the potential. And potentially all of them are a result of spontaneously broken scale symmetry. So one might imagine that the theory has scale symmetry near the Planck mass at very high energies, and this scale symmetry got conformally broken, spontaneously broken. Now you can lift the standard model to a theory with conformal symmetry by introducing a new scalar. So this conformal symmetry is a local version of scale symmetry, and it's easy to lift the standard model to a theory with this larger conformal symmetry. You introduce another scalar field, and the idea is that it's the VEV of this scalar field which gives rise to the mass parameters gives rise to all the mass parameters in the model. When you introduce this field, because it comes along with an extra symmetry, there are actually no new propagating degrees of freedom in the theory at all. So you really haven't added anything to the standard model. You've just extended it in order in an absolutely minimal way by adding a field and a local symmetry which removes all of its propagating degrees of freedom. You might say this field, so now this Lagrangian has conformal symmetry because this is a special value of the coefficient. And you see now that the Planck mass, the Einstein frame Planck mass, is the difference between the square of the new field and the Higgs square of the Higgs field. But I can always pick a conformal gauge in which that parameter is 1, and then I will go back to the Einstein frame description. So at first sight, you might say there's really nothing you've done. You've added a field, you've added a symmetry, there's no change in the theory, the physical degrees of freedom are unchanged. But in fact, what you do in doing this is open the possibility to new regions of field space. You see, in this original theory, the coefficient of the Ricci scalar was the Planck mass was strictly positive. In this theory, the coefficient can go negative. And in fact, generically, when you follow cosmological solutions, that's exactly what happens. The universe goes from a region with gravity to a region which superficially looks like it has anti-gravity. So you can study this FRW dynamics, just ordinary cosmological dynamics, in various gauges. And I just wanted to mention this, that the literature is, as soon as you have one scalar field in gravity, you can put it all over the place in the Lagrangian in front of R. This is sort of Higgs inflation, which honestly, from my opinion, is a lot of smoke and mirrors, because you can always, if you have one scalar field, you can always go to Einstein frame, and you can always pick the kinetic term to be minimal. And in that frame, everything is in here. So whatever you do in this theory really just amounts to changing the Higgs potential. So you can disguise it in various ways, but actually all you're doing is fiddling with the Higgs, potential. But for studying cosmological singularities, it's clear that if you want to resolve the Big Bang singularity, at least for FRW, you just want to go to a conformal gauge in which the determinant of the metric is -1, or unimodular gauge. That's a good gauge. And then at least the metric doesn't vanish, the scale factor doesn't vanish, and you can evolve the theory through the singularity. So let's see how to do that. If we take a flat FRW cosmology, you can define a violin variant field, which will be this new sort of ghost field. I didn't mention this field has a wrong sign kinetic term, but that's not a problem because I can always choose a gauge in which the field is constant. And so there are no physical degrees of freedom with negative kinetic terms. At least that field doesn't have associated with that field. So we can define a violin variant field phi and h. And so here you just cancel the conformal transformation properties of the scale factor. and phi and h, and then the action for these degrees of freedom. So this is the Einstein scalar action in these new degrees of freedom. It becomes the following, where phi squared minus h squared turns out to be the Einstein frame scale factor squared. And of course, when it vanishes, phi is equal to h. And in terms of the original Lagrangian, that is when the Planck mass, the sort of dynamical Planck mass, hits a zero. So here, this is just rewriting the Einstein-Higgs action in terms of these variables. And you can see that if I ignore the potential, and the potential is really subdominant near singularities. When you go near singularities, the kinetic energy, scales like 1 over 8 to the 6th, completely dominates over the potential. So the kinetic-dominated part of the dynamics, which is controlled by these terms, actually looks completely regular, and it is regular. There's absolutely nothing that goes wrong. So here we are in field space. The usual Einstein frame covers only a quarter of field space, because you say A, the scale factor, is positive, strictly positive. And this is the relationship between H and phi and A Einstein and sigma, the Einstein frame scalar field. So the usual Einstein frame only covers part of field space. And the obvious thing you can do in this bigger theory, this lifted theory, is traverse the anti-gravity region. So here, for example, is the simplest solution of a bouncing universe with a scalar field. Just a straight line. You see in the action I have phi prime squared is the kinetic term. So phi double prime is zero. So the solution is just phi goes like t, and this turns out to be, and then from the constraint equation, phi prime squared minus h prime squared is equal to rho r, and so you get this coefficient. So the simplest solution of this lifted theory is linear and just runs straight through the anti-gravity region and avoiding the and doesn't see any singularity at all. The Einstein frame scale factor is phi squared minus h squared, and this is t squared, that's the radiation component, and it goes negative for some small range of t squared, for some small range of t determined by t star, a coefficient which depends on the density of radiation, the Einstein frame scale factor goes negative. Now, a deeper and more powerful perspective on this is obtained not just by going to the extended field space, but actually following this analytic continuation prescription, which I was advocating before in the simpler context. So here we have a squared. It's completely analytic in t, just has two zeros. And then the scalar field turns out it diverges logarithmically as you approach one of those singularities where A vanishes. But actually, this is a ratio. This is a sum of two logs. And if t is negative, this is perfectly well defined. T if is less than minus t star, it's perfect. It's real. If t is greater than t star, it becomes real again. And so there's just some finite range of t star in which it's complex. And so the solution is complex, but it seems like a reasonable saddle point for a semi-classical approximation to the path integral. It does solve the Einstein equations. So this is what we do. We come in here towards a singularity. This is in the complex t-plane. We have a log branch cut in the scalar field. We just go above it. We go around the branch cut, around this anti-gravity region, come back to the real axis, and we have a unique solution. Now, if you do ask what really happened in this anti-gravity region, I'm not sure that's a sensible question, because it's only a question. I mean, it may just be an artifact of this low energy approximation. In order for this solution to be valid, what you need to do is keep away from these branch cuts and singularities. So, for example, you don't want linear perturbation theory to break down if you're studying cosmological perturbations. You don't want stringy corrections to be large if you're worried about those. And both of those will remain small if you stay sufficiently far from these singularities. Nevertheless, you might say, within this effective theory, if I do look at the anti-gravity region, what happens? Well, of course, A squared is negative, so A must be imaginary. And so let's change variables from A to I times B. And then the action for B looks like this, where the usual Einstein term has flipped sign. That's why it's called anti-gravity. The scalar kinetic term has flipped sign, and the potential remains the same. So what will be important later is that the relative sign of the kinetic energy for the scalar and its potential have flipped sign. And just to anticipate, the Higgs potential is negative at large sigma, seems to be negative at large sigma, while actually that would be perfect for driving inflation during this anti-gravity epoch. These other fields, sigma and alpha, they diverge logarithmically. Alpha, by the way, is anisotropy. They diverge logarithmically, and what that means is they acquire an extra imaginary piece, an I pi, which may be much smaller than their actual value. It can still be small. So I'll show you an example of a calculation. Let's try to ask what tensor modes are generated during such a transition. So here's my scale factor. I take the tensor equation. I do the usual change of variables. And here is the time-dependent mass term. So at first sight, there's no analytic solution to this equation. But there's a general argument that can show that actually there must be zero production of tensor modes as you traverse such a singularity. It's a bit surprising at first sight. Naively, you'd say, curvature diverges, I'm going to get a superabundance of tensor modes. But it's really not true. And I'll show you the argument. What we're doing is we're avoiding this branch cut by going around it in the complex T-plane. And of course, and we're in this radiation-dominated universe, you see, so in the radiation-dominated universe, this is zero. But actually, in this sort of combined universe, it's very small, provided the magnitude of T is large. So we just deform the contour, so that term is small. And in fact, what I want to do is deform that contour all the way to infinity in the Riemann sphere for T. So you see, to calculate particle production, I could do it the hard way and run along the real axis. I would have to avoid these singularities around t equals zero and go back the other side. Or I could just deform my contour that I'm solving the differential equation to actually go, in fact, I should have the arrow the other way. The contour can just go straight over the point at infinity and come in that side. And it's immediately obvious that that 1 over t squared term is very unimportant at large t. And so there's really no effect. It has no effect at all on the particle production. So if you send in an incoming positive frequency mode, you'll get out a pure positive frequency mode. So as I said, you can't solve this equation analytically. But if you integrate it numerically above singularities, this is what you get. Here's the incoming state. Chi is the mode function for the field. When it's pure positive frequency, this is a circle in the complex chi plane. So you send in a wave, it's a perfect circle. This is incoming. This is as you go through the transition. It does a funny loop, which depends on the contour you chose. And then as you go past the transition, it goes back to being a circle. So there's no graviton production at all. So that seems not to be a problem with this kind of background. Now, what if we add anisotropy? Because the claim was, people's often stated claim is, OK, you can study these special backgrounds, which seem to bounce. But what about generic backgrounds? In generic backgrounds, the perturbations will diverge. Well, the simple statement is that all the perturbations diverge in linear order only logarithmically. And logarithmically is exactly what we've dealt with already. But let's go nonlinear. Okay, so let's imagine there's some anisotropy. And we're really going to study the full nonlinear dynamics with anisotropy. So the simplest case is Bianchi 9, which is basically in the limit of these alphas being 0, it's a closed universe. So it's a closed universe with anisotropy, homogeneous but anisotropic. And this turns out to be the Einstein frame action. So the usual Einstein term, scalar field term, anisotropy. The anisotropy fields are just scalar fields in this. This is sort of dimensionally reduced action. And here's the potential for these fields. So let's study this. Well, the anisotropy potential, if you remember, this is what causes mixmaster chaos near singularities, right? So the scalar fields live in this positive potential, and basically, as you approach a singularity, they, in pure gravity, they would rattle around between these walls. These walls are exponential, and the field rattles around, and you get chaotic evolution as you approach the singularity. Now, I'm not worried about that because I'm going to go at large T, and the scale factor will never go to zero, and so we won't see chaotic evolution at all. So here's the integration contour I'm going to take. I'm just going to choose my contour. These are where the branch cuts are in the complex T plane. I'll just take the simplest integration contour that goes above. Necessarily, if you solve the equations, it doesn't matter which contour you pick. You have to get the same answer. And let's first evolve with small anisotropy. This is just an example. I just did this 2 days ago. And here it is. This is H and phi. And basically, you see a universe that goes through about 20 or 30 bounces. And it's absolutely fine. And in this phi H plane, this is my closed oscillating universe with anisotropy. Now, actually, this universe is like a little closed radiation-filled universe, and it's bouncing back and forth happily. But the anisotropy does grow slowly at each bounce. It grows very slowly. But that's not really the case we're interested in. We're interested in a universe with entropy production. I mean, this will bounce around, but whatever the universe does, it certainly creates entropy. So we expect the radiation density to grow, and it turns out that the including the simplest kind of entropy production, the density of radiation in a manner which is consistent with stress energy conservation, then this little bouncing universe grows in size. And this is the way it does it. The Higgs field gets smaller, loses energy to the radiation. The phi field gets larger. And here's the scale factor. If you look carefully, A squared goes negative, which it should. That's the anti-gravity regions, where A is IB. But actually, you'll notice the anti-gravity region becomes less and less and less important over time. The presence of radiation actually causes the universe to go faster through the anti-gravity region as the radiation builds up. And this is the main point. I started with small anisotropy. And this is the contribution of anisotropy to the potential relative to the curvature term, and you'll see it just decays away as the radiation is produced. So we seem to have some solutions of the Einstein-Higgs equations, which bounce unambiguously. Yes, they do have small complex pieces, but those complex pieces do not accumulate. They decay away as the universe becomes large, and it seems to be a legitimate semi-classical saddle point solution. So now let me get a little bit more ambitious and not just have a bouncing universe, but can I get something that looks like inflation in this anti-gravity region? And it seems that the answer is actually yes, because a negative Higgs potential, which is what LHC implies, behaves like a positive potential in this anti-gravity region. So the observed one goes like minus sigma to the fourth with a coupling. This tiny coupling we need in lambda phi 4 inflation is actually still allowed by LHC. In fact, LHC allows the potential to be slightly positive. But this is certainly allowed by the data, and I am wildly extrapolating this potential to large, to sigma beyond M Planck, at 10 or 20 M Planck, of course, to get the right predictions. But of course, what will follow is we'll just get the tensor prediction from lambda phi to the fourth, which is pretty reasonable. What? Well, it's a bit unclear what's ruled out at the moment, okay, to be honest. So, and like I said, this was a pretty big extrapolation by a factor of 10. So there are significant uncertainties, both certainly on the theory side and it seems on the experimental side too. Okay, so this is what it would look like in the phi H plane. We go into an exponentially expanding dark energy phase. It will end when the Higgs field tunnels through the barrier. The sigma field will run off to infinity. The universe will collapse. When it collapses, it enters this anti-gravity region. Enters the anti-gravity region, the scalar field zooms in from plus infinity, running down this sigma to the fourth potential, will generate scale invariant perturbations and tensor modes. But you see, if you flip this potential upside down, it has a negative region here. And as this field runs down, that negative region will cause the anti-gravity region to collapse, and you'll go back into a gravity region, and the cycles will continue with the universe getting bigger and bigger each time. So just to end, I want to mention that if you have such a scenario, actually it does other things for you, one of which is that it gives you a very nice way to generate the baryon asymmetry of the universe. You know, they're probably the most favored scenario right now is leptogenesis, where you generate a lepton asymmetry somewhere in the early universe using Majorana couplings to super heavy Higgs bosons, and then later convert that lepton asymmetry into a baryon asymmetry through the electroweak anomaly. But that scenario is very contrived. When you go through the details of it, it's very contrived and very difficult to make work in detail, because you're doing it in the middle of this thermal equilibrium state, and it's hard to there's no natural reason to depart from thermal equilibrium, and you really have to depart from thermal equilibrium to make baryon asymmetry. So in this scenario, we have a clear way of doing this, because this phi field, this ghost field, has no new propagating degrees of freedom, but nevertheless, it can certainly flip sign, and it does flip sign. As you pass an anti-gravity region, it changes sign. And that's something that you could never describe in Einstein frame. And so if we take the simplest solution, which is just that phi is mu t, I think I didn't write it down. Mu is am, and then m is the mass of the fermion, will basically be a Yukawa coupling. Phi will be proportional to t, and this mu parameter, a times m in the Dirac equation, will be given by this. This is essentially the phi going like rho r to the half t. This is the Yukawa coupling. And so the quantity occurring in the Dirac equation, the mass, is proportional to t, and flip sign at t equals 0. So you can solve that equation, work out the number of particles you get. It's completely finite and goes like this parameter to the 3/2. So it goes like the Yukawa coupling of the right-handed neutrinos to the 3/2 times the density of radiation to the 3/4 times some CP-violating parameter squared coming from the matrix element. And so this the number over entropy, the number of leptons, the lepton asymmetry has this parametric dependence. So it just depends on this Yukawa coupling. And this is then converted to the, this should be NB, the baryon asymmetry via the B plus L anomaly. So it seems like we have an extremely simple method for non-equilibrium production of leptons, which would then very naturally give a baryon asymmetry of roughly the right order. Conclusion. Very simple approach to bounces. There are certain virtues in that. We still need to include or parametrize entropy generation at the bounce, which would result from microphysics. So that was not, I didn't tackle that at all. But perhaps in due course, this can become a competitor in inflation. Thanks very much.
Questions?
So I have a question about the analytic continuation. Mm. So usually we have physical reasons that allow us to avoid singularities. For instance, the I epsilon prescription in Feynman diagrams can be thought of as coming from a projection onto the lowest energy state at minus infinity. Here, yes. It seems to me you are pointing to the singularity head on, and what's is there a physical reason why you should be able to avoid it going in the complex plane?
No, because we don't know the physics here, okay? So the point is that if the effective theory, this is the conjecture, that if the low energy effective theory remains valid on this contour in the complex T plane, then actually you don't care about this region. That's the state.
Is that right? I mean, there's no guarantee that the actual integrated effect of going through the region is the same as going off in the complex
plane. As I said, if the low energy theory is valid at large magnitude of T, then this is valid. The Stokes lines, yeah, that's a, we discussed this earlier. When we deal with quantum mechanics in the time-independent Schrodinger equation, you find that the WKB approximation, semi-classical approximation, fails at turning points, okay? And then one way of tackling that is to do exactly what I'm doing, but you continue in X, right? You go in the complex plane on some contour that avoids the turning point, and you go from one side to the other, and you get exactly the right result. That is a bit different to the setup. What I'm doing is I'm evolving in time. You see, let me give you another example. So standard WKB, as I said, is in the time-independent picture, and you're making the quantum variable X complex, not making the time complex. If you try to treat what I'm going to say is let me just see if I can say it clearly. The question is, can I go round these turning points? And so, in standard quantum mechanics, you can. Well, you don't need to know the. If your approximation was valid along the contour you took, then you can. That's the statement. Okay, so that you're talking about the Stokes phenomenon. So Stokes phenomenon, you see when you solve, let's say, quantum mechanics with a linear potential, and you find the Airy function, which has these Stokes lines. Okay, and so if you try to match the different solutions, one is for example, you try to match incoming. The solutions are sinusoidal on one side and exponential on the other. So yes, that's described by this Stokes phenomenon. If you adopt this approach, you see, if you say let me continue in time. So if you study the time-dependent problem in that case, in fact, there are no ambiguities with the Stokes lines. And the reason is that you're studying a linear potential, right? In time dependent, you're doing a path integral for a linear potential. But, okay.
But the
analogous phenomenon actually doesn't happen in this situation.
Are there any other questions?
No, I'm happy to continue.
I just want a clarification, Neil, so I can take a message back to the Planck team. How big an R do we have to confirm in order to never hear about cyclic universes ever again?
The old cyclic universe. By the original one, you mean, the ekpyrotic universe. That was the context of the bet. the ekpyrotic universe, you know, which we hoped would come out of M theory and brains, that's the one that the bet was about. And in that scenario, yeah, I don't think there's any way to reproduce R. You know, that's why I bet either of 1% would be fine. So you won't hear about it again from me. I mean, people here will confirm that when I heard about this result, I said, whew, I don't have to work on that anymore. That's great.
Okay, with a reminder that dinner is immediately next, I'm willing to take one last question. Okay. Oh, Dodi, okay.
So Neil, I'm presuming in this model that the right-handed neutrinos are the dark matter?
Yes.
Is there a prediction for the mass?
Yes, in principle.
Do you have a ballpark number?
We haven't worked it out. But you would generate a lepton asymmetry, and actually Latham has thought about this more than me. He can maybe answer.
Unfortunately, there was no prediction. No, the dark matter mass fixes one of the right-handed neutrino Yukawa couplings, but that is currently free.
All right. Well, let's thank Neil and, in fact, all the speakers of this session and the whole day. It's been a wonderful collection of talks.